Welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 10. This week's topics will include NSA data collection and U.S. unemployment situation. Today I am joined by Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, Chelsea Camo, and Lydia Tabbitt. But before we start talking about our usual topics, I'd really like to talk about this Bundy Ranch situation that we've had going on in Nevada. What do you guys think of this whole situation?
Well, Kirk, you had an interesting view on this, which I wasn't really aware of. It's kind of the solar array angle on what's happening over there.
Yeah, my understanding, InfoWars found some documentation behind the deal with Harry Reid and the Chinese government putting in a business to do some solar panels for some new green technology. And they needed this rancher off the land that he was using. And once that got exposed, the feds said that they were, or the Bureau of Land Management started, the government said they were going to back down, saying that there were security issues and potential injuries about to happen because of all the people standing up to the government there. And I thought it was pretty interesting for this whole liberty topic that we like to talk about. So I was... If I was in Nevada, I would have been out there if I could have. I like to see people stand up for what they, agreements that they had and for their own rights. So,
but only in the free speech area, right?
What do you mean free speech area? No.
They had, I think the first few days that they're early parts of when they were having people demonstrating there, they had set aside a specific area where it was the only place. This is on supposedly public property.
A free speech zone?
They had designated it, yes, designated it a free speech area. I forget if it was First Amendment area or free speech area.
First Amendment area.
Of course, someone put some sense in the whole thing and put a sign underneath that said there's no such thing as a free speech area or a First Amendment area underneath the government sign. I can quick pull up the photo and I can put it on the page or something, but that was interesting.
Yes, you should do that, Lydia, so our site is a free speech area.
There's a place like that at the San Francisco airport I saw it a few years back, and it was just this free speech zone, and it was a couple benches facing each other, and I was like, oh, really? So now it's very clear. We don't have free speech, just in certain areas?
Your rights are only your rights in certain designated spots.
Exactly.
And there may or may not be some microphones under those benches.
I feel like there's got to be like some dumbass dude who was like, let's call it the First Amendment area. It's very clever. Not realizing the implications of that kind of a decision. Like, oh yeah, this sounds real good. But then, truth hits and all of a sudden they all look like a bunch of idiots.
What did that even mean? I was kind of out of the loop for the last week, but why did they even have because I saw an article and a picture of that First Amendment area, but why did they put that up?
Well, they didn't want the protesters getting involved with the actual operation.
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Sorry, what'd you say, Matt?
Well, it seemed to me that they just essentially set it up so that the protesters wouldn't interfere with the operations of the BLM.
Yeah.
Well, they've been doing that everywhere now. I mean, at any given point of anything major, they always set up these free speech zones. It's nothing, this isn't anything new.
Oh, I haven't noticed that before.
It's they do it all over the place.
Well, they have them on public college campuses. That's something I don't know if have we done a podcast on free speech?
No.
This is a little off topic, so I'll be brief. But there's a national organization called the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and they work in fighting speech codes and free speech zones and First Amendment issues on college campuses. And there's some good clips and things on that we could discuss or at another time. But this idea that you have a designated zone for your rights, specifically free speech, is not the first time that has occurred.
Well, and what do you guys think about, I know this is still off our designated topic, but all the legislation about hate speech. I mean, do you think that that's an infringement on our, you know, First Amendment rights, considering if you say the wrong thing or if it's interpreted the wrong way, they have every legal right to throw you in prison?
Codes or regulations on hate speech, only on harassment, and I think that maybe makes more sense. And so you can say things that are offensive or challenging or might make people uncomfortable, but as soon as you start targeting people, that's where there's an issue. And I think that's maybe makes more sense, at least to me. But I don't know. Free speech is something that I am more passionate about, so I could go on for a while.
Yeah, and I haven't.
Well, it's an important topic. There's a reason it was number one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah.
I don't know. For me, but harassment or not, I mean, leave the harassing area. The right to be able to say what you want to say should be protected.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Well, it really shows how far we've come that our government feels like it's necessary to set up free speech zones because they have it coordinated, you know, quarantined off that you can't be, you know, we're involved here now. So it's the growing trend, and I think people are becoming more and more aware, and it's good that organizations like ours are out there, you know, promoting liberty. So,
right, and I think another thing that's sort of related to this Bundy Ranch story, which is something I think is becoming increasingly more apparent in the news, is the militarization of the police or of law enforcement. I think that's something else that we see more and more frequently in the news.
Yeah, I think we need to do a podcast on that for sure, because that has been growing leaps and bounds the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Military hardware, sniper training, everything. It's
so what
training cops are having today is pretty crazy.
One of the things that I find interesting about what happened with this whole BLM situation is they actually tried to auction off some of those stolen cattle, and the auction venue was like, no, we're not going to sell them. We won't do it. They literally refused to do it. They're like, no, you stole those. We won't sell stolen cattle.
Nice.
Yeah, to me, that's a win for the U.S. Citizens, you know.
Absolutely.
Well,
screw you guys.
I mean, that's how you change things. That's how the only way things are going to change is if ordinary, you know, people stand up for something and say what you're doing is wrong or what you're doing is in violation of the Constitution or we disagree with. That's the only way things will change.
So I really didn't even watch any videos, but I saw a few pictures where there was a standoff where you saw it was almost like a citizen militia against BLM under a bridge. Do you guys, what exactly was going on there? That, you know, I saw a lot of links to that, but I'm not really sure what was happening, because it.
From what I have been able to gather, the militias, quote unquote, were very small groups of people. We're talking like a group of five and a group of four and a group of three, and it was like four or five actual groups that showed up. We're only talking like a total of 20 people dressed up in army gear.
Okay.
And the thing that happened under the bridge was between protesters and the feds. So it wasn't between like militias standing up with a bunch of firearms.
So, okay.
More a bunch of people with signs saying, screw you.
Yeah, because it looked like there were more than 20 protesters.
Yeah, but in the militia people, to be clear, the militia people who I've seen are literally dressed up in camouflage. They're wearing army style fatigues, not wearing like the don't tread on me stuff. So that's been my understanding anyway. And I know there's been over 1,000 people at pretty much every one of these protests that have gone on so far, which, you know, these feds are obviously very nervous, especially when they start seeing the people rolling around in trucks wearing full fatigues. I'm not going to comment on the intelligence of people who are in these federal positions, but scare people, they're going to do things. And I think the reason why they reacted the way they did as far as pushing the pregnant woman to the ground and hazing people are because they were scared.
So the end result was basically nothing happening, right?
Well, as soon as InfoWars came out, with, like Kirk said, with that information about the Chinese investment on solar farms, it disappeared.
Yeah. Well, the feds backed down. They gave the cattle back to save a little face. But this solar farm is still being – they just broke ground.
It's a huge, what, $5 billion solar farm?
Yeah. Yeah. And then Harry Reid's been saying that it's not over yet.
Yeah.
So the government's going to come back at it. Just, it's going to be a prolonged thing. I think it'll probably end up fading out of the media now because supposedly it's over. But so now what happens is really going to be the inside stuff that, you know, once the media backs away and doesn't want to cover what the government's doing again, so we'll see if it escalates again.
So, what do you guys think? To me, and I don't know a lot about what's gone on or the backstory behind this, but it seems like, you know, a possible scenario is that the rancher and government work out some type of scenario where he can utilize federal land to feed his cattle that may not, you know, it just may not hit up against the real estate that's being developed and, you know, maybe fade away after that.
I guess I don't know. It's kind of speculation at this point.
That's why I wanted to talk about it another day when I had more time to do some research about it, but
let's come back to it then.
Well, yeah, I think we will, but it's questionable why some people, I mean, who gives this guy the right to utilize the land too, though? So it's kind of a double-edged issue here that really, by eminent domain standards, if you maintain property, you can pretty much claim it as you can take ownership of that property.
Well, Kirk, from what I understand, his family's been farming this land since the 1870s.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my point. To me, it's more of this family's land over more than the government's land in the first place. For the laws, if this was private property, if this wasn't the federal government's public land, and this was private property, that Bundy would be able to claim this land as his own. But since it's the government's land, you can't do that. To me, things don't
just makes sense and everything. And I wish we're gonna. I gotta do more research. Happy from what, you know, that people are standing up, you know, against BLM. So
what's that, Chelsea?
Bundy actually owns the water and forage rights to the land. So he doesn't own the land itself, but it sounds like he's had a very long standing contract with Clark County. And that predates the BLM. And so I would assume if you own the water rights and the forage rights, how can someone just come in and say, this isn't your land, and boot you off? How does that work if you own the water rights but not the land itself?
Right, and that's a very fair point to make.
Well, all I can say is if you mowed an extra yard into your neighbor's yard every week for years on end, that yard ends up being your own. You could go to court over it and end up with that portion of land as your own. You could actually build a fence.
I've heard that. Like, you maintain it, then it becomes yours.
Yes. And so, essentially, that's what Bundy has been doing. And it's, to me, if the law transcends, which it's supposed to, from government to citizen, there's no special treatment, the government should forfeit this land anyways.
But there's significant amount of money at play, which changes.
Yeah, well, that's the whole reason why this ever began. I mean, why did the federal government all of a sudden step in and confiscate his cattle?
Yeah. Well,
obviously, from what InfoWars released, that it's, you know, this Chinese solar farm did not want the cattle there, so they requested them be gone, and lo and behold, our government cow ties to what a foreign government or corporation wants to utilize this land, neighboring land, and they can't have this cattle there. So, $5 billion or American citizen? What do you do?
It's interesting to me is why, you know, what's the incentive to work with the Chinese government on generating electricity in an environment like this? Why wouldn't the U.S. government be more interested in that? I don't really understand that.
Well, in this day and age, why wouldn't that happen? But if we were talking from a liberty sense, government shouldn't have anything involved in it in the first place. But
yeah. The situation, well, is that the western part of the United States is most of the land is owned by the government. But
my guess would be these solar panels are going to be produced in China. They're not going to be produced in America because America can't. It's too generally too toxic and too not cost effective. So they have to be produced in China. So maybe some of these businesses can only, their only business plan that they can make a profit from is the Chinese government. So they're the only ones willing to put $5 billion into this. And it is a surprising thing for how, yeah, much money we've been throwing at the green technologies. I hate even saying the term, but that we're not doing that ourselves, but that is a totally great aspect to think about. But
sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think at this point, I'd like to talk about this NSA situation. I know,
well,
we've talked about it before.
Tie in that what Lydia was saying earlier about our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, is how that's been eroding faster and faster, it seems. And yet, at the same time, all this data collection that the NSA is doing, so they can control it from both ends. So when they do have the mechanism to oust free speech, they have the technology now that the NSA does. And
right.
So it's going to be the tie-in.
One of the...
You were bringing up, Matt.
Yeah, there's been a few things that have come out recently. You know, we've talked about this before, but there's been more information that's come out recently revealing the kind of records that they have collected. You know, we've all heard about the cell phone bill thing, and, you know, they're following your cell phone around and your calls, and they're recording that information. But there's been a lot more revelation of what they've been proposing to collect and what would be allowed from the Wyden-Udall letter, which would include some, but not all, library book records. Now, okay, so I'm going to do the House version and the Senate version. So the House version shows some, but not all, library book records, firearm sales records, tax return records, education records, and then some, but not all, medical records. You know, that's shocking enough. But then the Senate version also includes credit card purchases, pharmacy records, library records, firearm sales records, financial information, and then a bit more of other random stuff. So between the combination of these two, it's slightly unremarkable that they're going after firearms records, because I expected that many, many years ago that would be something that they were already collecting. However, some of this stuff is kind of shocking to me, like the pharmacy records. Like, what? Wait, why? Why do you want my pharmacy records? What possible use of my pharmacy records would that be to the protection of the United States? Seriously, I need to go get a new inhaler for my asthma, and the NSA wants to know about it? You got to be kidding me.
Well, I think that's probably, and I forget, Matt, if you were at when we had Twyla Brace from the Citizens Council for Health Freedom at one of our meetings, but, I mean, there is a lot to be said about the connection with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, with other government agencies.
Well, it's a data collection scheme.
Yep.
Is what the Affordable Care Act really is, which ties into everything else, and that's, like... Well, here's the other thing. Every time the government's saying that, we're going to not take your information, we're going to figure out a new way to do it, Obama just, he said he was going to do that, then he'd pass a 90-day extension. But then the bills being proposed are even worse than what it is essentially. They're just switching it to be held in the private sector, and the government can go and take it at any time.
Right, but it sounds better because it's being held by the private companies.
Well, I mean, but that's what I was going to bring it up, is because the pharmaceutical companies could be doing the same thing, and the government could go and take it at the same time as well. But it really just shows, I mean, the government, this ties into everything we've talked about. The whole, when we were talking about Ukraine, about how you study the people, the players at hand, and these algorithms that they have produced that they can create the new reality just by doing a little propaganda here, because we know the people are like this, and if we just throw this little propaganda, we can adjust this aspect of our algorithm, this the persona of what people have out there, that, all right, this will sway the country this way, or what. And it's all about control. Information is control, and I don't even think they know how to utilize it yet, but they know they will be. And so that's why we're at the precipice of real tyranny coming forth in America, of a total lockdown of this new form of government that it's borders line. They keep saying democracy. They have all this information about people. They can say, all right, this is will get us above 50%, 60%. You know, let's play it safe. We always want to be at 60%. And they can play it that way because they just know everything about everyone. And you can mass analysis of this people's data, programmed into the algorithm, and play with it here and there with certain propaganda, certain tactics, or certain leaders that could sway this way and that, and they can pretty much generate any outcome they want just by the control of the media, the control of the information, and they know everything about everyone. And then when there is real dissent, everything's illegal. You can go and bust anyone on anything, so then you can go and imprison someone over anything. So it's a conundrum that America is going to face, and it's going to spread throughout the world.
I don't know. It's hard for me when I talk to some people who have the state of mind of saying, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why do I care if they're searching
my records? I hate
that. Have a good clip.
I know.
Fantastic clip on that.
What was it? Oh, okay.
We got a clip?
Oh, yeah.
Let's play it.
Play it? Yeah, all right.
Number two, Wendy Malik, your question, please, for Alabama. Government tracking of phone records has been in the news lately. Is this an invasion of privacy or necessary to keep our country safe? Why or why not?
I think the society that we live in today, it's sad that if we go to the movies or to the airport or even to the mall, that we have to worry about our safety. So I would rather someone track my telephone messages and feel safe wherever I go than feel like they're encroaching on my privacy.
Just cut it off.
That's nice.
Yay!
That's Miss Alabama.
I feel so dangerous going to the mall. I'm sorry. My goodness. Going to the airport. My God, I'm so glad they track everything.
Yeah, because them checking my phone messages is going to make me safer at the mall.
What a PC answer. Was that Miss America pageants?
It was Miss Alabama.
I know, but was that like for Miss USA or something like that? Or?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was Miss Alabama?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how many people really think that, but...
Well, who's really afraid of terrorism? It's all generated. To me, it just boggles my mind that we have to fear these people in the world that may or may not want to do us harm. And, the control we're granting government and the erosion of our liberties is staggering at best. And
well, and I think this is another important point to make. We had this discussion at our local convention a couple months ago about, you know, if you don't have, you know, anything to hide or that kind of argument. And one of the fellow yowlers made which I think is a really good point, made the point of, you know, I don't even know what the number is, but, you know, there's this estimated average of how many felonies the average American commits per day. And it's an unbelievable number. And you think about how many rules and regulations that the average American just, you know, is completely oblivious to. And as soon as you target one of those regulations, one of those rules, and you're I'm blanking on the word.
An insider.
Well, no, you're
an outsider.
You're charged with breaking one of those rules or not following one of those rules or regulations. Then the government now has access to all of this personal information on yourself. For doing something that you didn't even know was wrong.
We keep adding laws every single year. We add and add and add and add and add laws ad infinitum, and we never take any away. So you can have just a multitude of laws that are never enforced anymore or people aren't aware of. But I think what you were kind of talking about a little bit, Lydia, is to say that each and every single one of us could be considered a criminal according to some law or another, whether or not we're even aware that they exist.
Right.
So then, say that I become a political activist and maybe I get a groundswell or some movement and someone feels threatened, well, then all they need to do is just take my data and throw me in jail on some BS law that just happens to be there.
I actually think it's scarier when you consider the fact that they can take your family aside and apply these things to them. Because you as a political leader might be willing to make those sacrifices. However, they can drag your family into it and say, oh, yeah, well, we know that so-and-so has committed this crime. And you're like, what? That's not even a crime. And they're like, nope, according to the criminal code, that's a felony. So,
well,
unless
just look
you
at
back
Clive
off,
Fundy. This is what we were talking about earlier. This guy was living his life. Next thing you know, his government wants that land, so they go and confiscate his cattle. And bring him to federal court, and apparently he lost in federal court. But
actually, I have a decent example. I have a decent personal example of this. Last summer, I remember this so well, but my mom had asked me, we were doing stuff outside in the garden, and she'd asked me to set up like a ladybug trap, or like Asian beetle or whatever they're called, kind of trap thing to put near the plants or whatever so bugs won't eat her plants. And I'm setting this thing up and I'm, you know, reading the instructions, which first of all puts me in, I don't even know what kind of minority. Like, I guarantee you no one reads these instructions. But I'm going through it and I get to this part that says, you know, failure to adhere to these instructions or to correctly follow this protocol is a felony. I mean, that for setting up a bug trap. I mean, these are the kind of things that, you know, we don't even think about it in our day-to-day lives, but if they're, you know what I mean? Like, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about with
who the hell is walking around enforcing those laws?
Frivolous policies.
But the idea is that they could if they wanted to. If you were a threat to them, that they... Oh, he said, who's walking around and enforcing this? It's like, well, it's sort of like a back pocket plan. It's like, yeah, we'll let you live your lives, but if you cause us trouble, I swear to God, I'm coming after you and you not following the protocol on that bug trap. Say goodbye to your...
Right. And how do you fight something like that? When your opposition has this kind of power and information, I mean, it's
just teach people about jury nullification.
Well, there you go.
Are you guys familiar with that, jury nullification?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. Where somebody can be guilty of sin, but a jury can say, or can basically vote that you're not guilty because they think that the law itself is baloney.
No, it's not that they vote you not guilty. They vote you guilty, but then they say, but there's no punishment for this because we don't think that there's any crime here. So
I thought it was.
No, yeah. They can nullify the law.
Exactly. So you can vote them guilty of the law, but nullify the consequences of it. So, yeah. Let's teach people about this. Now all of a sudden these frivolous crap laws are no longer necessary. They no longer have an impact.
It would gum up the court system so bad the government would freak out if everyone went to a jury trial.
Well, if you guys...
Yeah, well, my brother's gotten out of quite a bit of tickets where he was absolutely... Or, wait, I shouldn't say that. He could have possibly been perceived as guilty, but because he demanded a jury trial, they let him off because they didn't want to go through the whole rigmarole.
There you go.
But, I know. No, that's why.
If you're... just an interesting aside. If you ever tell a attorney who's trying to judge you for jury duty, and you tell them that you know about jury nullification, there's very, very, very good chance that they will not choose you to be on. So, if you want to get out of jury duty...
I would rather actually utilize that power than tell someone that I know about it.
Yeah, but a savvy attorney will ask you the question, like, early on in the examination process. Do you know anything that would not allow you to interpret the law within the strictest letter of its intent? And you would say, yes, I do. And then they say, really? What do you know? And then you say, I know about jury nullification. They'll be like, okay, you're dismissed. You know, so
intent is a very gray word, though, because if you think about intent, maybe you could stretch it so far as to say is intent of someone actually doing harm. And if the
however, that said, if you don't answer that truthfully and you get caught, you can end up in contempt of court and end up with a felony yourself. So you have to say yes. Yes, I do. I know about this thing.
Oh, maybe it is. The question.
So, Matt, what were you saying earlier about, again, about what you opened with on the essay?
So, there are several things that are being collected right now. Credit card purchases, pharmacy records, library records, firearm sales records, financial information... I mean, these are things that are being collected for every U.S. citizen. This isn't just people who are suspected of crimes. So one of the ones, obviously, you guys all know this, that concerns me the most is the firearm sales records. It's been long suspected by the gun-owning public that the government is building a registry so that they can go and confiscate guns if they want to at any point in the future. It's their prerogative that if there was going to be any kind of a rebellion that they want to disarm the population. It's much easier to take over a population that's disarmed. And we understand from our founding fathers that that's a really, really slippery slope. The Second Amendment is there for a specific reason. It's not because we need to keep a well-regulated militia. Rather, we need to be able to defend ourselves from the tyranny of the people who are elected into power.
You mean like at the Bundy Ranch where he set up militias to defend himself?
I was going to say, do you mean there's not a Second Amendment area, Matt?
Oh, how awesome would that be? They set up right next to it a Second Amendment area where everybody can stand with their firearms.
And then they just line up cannons. Go ahead, stand here, I dare you.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of tanks there. Exactly. So, essentially, when I'm looking at this data collection, I'm insanely disappointed. When I was growing up, I had an expectation that we lived in a country that was a freedom-loving society. That we had the best intentions all the time as far as trying to keep people free, keep people in the so that they have the ability to live the American dream, and that there wasn't a lot going on in the background to prevent that. However, I think we are finding out now, kind of pissing in our cereal, that that's absolutely not true. We're in a society at this point where there's a lot of people who are corrupt and they'd like to take over. They'd like to stop the rest of us from living our lives freely and be able to collect from our pocketbook as much as they can in order to bloat their own power. And yeah, I think we're kind of screwed.
You want me to go all conspiratorial on you?
Kirk, I always want you to go conspiratorial.
Like,
what are you talking about?
Well, when I reflect on all this stuff, I really don't see America becoming such a controlling state that where they're going to confiscate our firearms and everything, unless there becomes a new world government and they can't have Americans with all this firearms in their households and the ability to just say, screw you, we want to stay our own sovereign state away from this global entity. And I think that's really what backfires. It's a complex matter, but I don't see in America being what it is. I mean, America just won't be anything resembling of itself, and it'd be such a drastic change if they went and confiscated firearms that I think America would cease to exist. So I think it's just coupled, it's going to be timed with a new world organization that governance in a way that is going to follow with a global recession, global depression, and it's going to, I don't know. Does that make any sense? That I really
Who's
don't see America with
happening?
The Constitution we have. Well, that's what I'm saying. I believe that this is what it's leading to. That all this data collection information is setting the stage for America to crumble in a way. And when it crumbles, when the new world governance is formed, that's when they'll go in and take all the weapons and everything because they can't have all of us sovereign citizens uprising and saying, screw you guys, we just want to be our own country. And, you know, we have the knowledge, we have the technology, we have the skills, we have
the workforce to be a free society. And don't need you guys to govern our lives.
The most clear evidence that we need is specifically that both the Senate and the House version both include firearm sales records, and that is clearly against the intention of Congress. I mean, Congress has never intended that there would be records collected of private firearms sales.
Private firearm sales. They already
have. I'm not saying person to person. I'm saying literally just firearm sales in general, from private business to individual.
I assume they already do that. I don't think they need the legislation behind it.
The intent from Congress has never been to allow for that type of data collection.
And at any rate, what happened to the unreasonable search and seizure aspect of our rights? Well, I mean, just because they're not physically looking in my home, exactly, just because they're not, like, actually coming into my residence and, you know, inventorying things, doesn't mean that an electronic search is any less an unreasonable search than a physical one is. Like, why are people not upset about this? I mean, it's not like we have, you know, 100 or 1,000.
So important, but yeah, I absolutely agree with you. The text reads, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, suborned by oath or affirmation. Yeah, exactly. And particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So this bulk data collection is absolutely bunk based on what our Constitution says. Any case ever brought before a federal judge should be thrown the hell out if it was established based on data that was collected in mass. But they're not. That's the horrible part. They're not thrown out.
If you have the data, then you could just, you know, maybe assign an IRS audit to just, I don't know, randomly select someone to be audited because you already have some sort of information that, you know, without a warrant, you don't need a warrant to audit somebody, but you could collect data and say, oh, this is a guy we're a little worried about. He might be a revolutionary. Let's go audit him and hope we can find something. You know, there are workarounds, there are loopholes. And I think that, I don't know if it's just been in conversations I've had with Kirk or if he mentioned it on here, but, you know, something, gosh, I'm trying to remember. Kirk, do you want to jump in here? Do you remember what you were saying about this?
I'm not following where you're leading.
Okay. All right.
I understand what you're saying.
Think of this. When was it in the?
Oh, I remember what it was, Kirk. Well, you were saying it's like, well, the NSA will gather all the data and then they technically won't do anything with it, but then it'll be available for different branches of government to utilize.
Yes, or different organizations. That's what the NSA says. Yeah, we don't do any of this, but they pass it along to other organizations that go and do something, and so it's never tied back to the NSA data. It's,
right, so they can say, oh, we don't do anything with it.
We know you're doing this, so we're going to figure out how to bust you and do anything like that. Or, you know, if they want to go after anyone, the NSA is not going to come knocking on your door.
Right.
It's going to be some other form of government agency, and it's not going to be tied back to the NSA 90% of the time.
And this isn't just theory. I mean, we've seen targeted attacks by the IRS. Of people that they found to be politically threatening.
Who's getting fired right now? She's getting thrown out. What's her name?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, the deputy director of the IRS.
Oh, Lois Lerner?
Yes.
Is that who it is? Yes.
I don't think she's getting thrown out, though.
Yeah, she's not getting thrown out yet.
Oh, what's going on then?
She will
getting
be.
Pressured
to? Their Congress is debating that.
She resign?
Her up on charges, I think, is what...
Yeah, they're debating about bringing up charges because of...
Or she's on paid leave, or I can't remember exactly, but think she's. I don't think she's testified yet. I think she's.
Well, she's been claiming the Fifth every time, and she gave up her rights by giving a testimony right away. But
But then, of course, we are all still paying her salary for someone who may or may not have, you know, used the government agencies inappropriately for political gains or political
monetary attack on political adversaries.
Yeah. Well,
and we're becoming to see this more and more because presidents don't go after past presidents or their administrations. So I think Obama's just playing his cards right now that, you know what, the next president's not going to come after me or my administration. So anything we do, as long as we just keep dragging our feet and keeping this out of the courts and out of the public mainstream mindset or whatnot, that we're going to get away with anything anyways. And he has the support of both parties, both establishments, for certain things. You can play both sides as you go off each other, with each other. It doesn't matter. It's just continuation keeps going. But it's what I was going to bring up is, let's say they confiscate guns. What's the difference? Do you think that's the worst thing ever? I mean, they've confiscated gold in America. We rounded up Japanese Americans during World War II. I mean, it's we've seen a lot of overreaches by our federal government plenty of times in the history of our country.
Oh, right. And the Constitution is only there for convenience.
I mean, are we really seeing more of this, or is this just because of the internet and whatnot that it becomes more exposed and government actions are being exposed? I mean, if I was the president of the United States, I would want all this data. I'm not going to lie. I would want this data. Why would you not? Why would the government not want this data? And they're just propagandizing the public to accepting this data. And I don't think the public realizes the damning effects in the long run, but.
Well, it's sort of like when I first heard of, it's how you frame it. So like when I first heard about hate speech legislation, I didn't really think much of it at the time. It's like, okay, fine. They want to legislate people not being, you know, totally horrible to each other. Big deal. But then I started to think about the implications of it, you know, and I think that's where we come again. They can form something in such a way, oh, it's for your safety, like the Patriot Act. When I heard about the Patriot Act, I got so pissed because it wasn't about keeping us safe from terrorism. To me, it was even if you trust whatever administration is in office, even if you think they're doing it for the right reasons, once you give government the power to do so, you don't ever get that power back. They don't go, okay, well, the threat's gone now, we're going to get rid of the Patriot Act. Or, oh, you know, everybody's safe again, so we're going to stop spying on you. That's not how it works. It never goes the other direction. And I think over time, they've been slowly been able to whittle away all of our rights and all of our expectations of our rights, and then being able to push people into complacency, like, oh, well, it's fine if we're spying on you as long as you're not doing anything wrong. So what's the big deal? And getting people more and more and more comfortable with just relinquishing the freedoms that we once had.
Well, I just don't think people, even people that desire freedom, don't even respect freedom. People are so irritated with one another, with the effects people have on each other, that, oh, this person said this, they're doing this, that's bugging my life. It's the whole concept of pursuit of happiness and the lack of government control is so foreign to people's mindsets today that it just boggles my mind that it's the correct argument isn't even brought up ever, in my opinion.
Right, they changed the conversation.
Well, it's not even the media or the government. I just think it's the public at large. People really just don't give a shit.
Well, part of it's the way that we've been propagandized our entire life. Because, I mean, I, as a kid, I thought that this was a great freedom-loving country with good principles and values, and it was something I could really believe in, and yay, the American dream, but it was a whole crock of baloney the entire time. It really was. I was just too young to know better. You know, but some people don't necessarily take the steps to critically analyze whether all of the propaganda is true or whether it's just propaganda.
Well, propaganda is not necessarily, I mean, we should be propagandizing for liberty and freedom at the same time. It's just that constant push of keeping it fresh in people's minds. I mean, what is education? I mean, if you...
Well, there's a difference between education and indoctrination.
It's being eroded.
Well, oh, I wouldn't disagree with you.
Yeah, I think there's...
I don't know. I'm just getting off topic. I don't know about that. I think with things like the internet, I think we have more access to more and different sources of information than ever before. There's also that argument to be made. But absolutely. In terms of how the government presents itself, there's something to be said about that.
Well, all right, let me ask you this. What is the internet?
It's a series of tubes.
Yeah, but what do we pay for the internet? For
Levin.
Let's say back in the 1800s when they're putting all the railroad track down. That was infrastructure cost, and people had to pay to use it. We are becoming so accustomed to the free internet is what I want. I'm going to put in free in quotations. We do pay for it, but it's... It's kind of... I'm having a trouble trying to convey my thoughts on it, but... It's out there for free in a way. Everything on the internet's for free. There's a lot of open source community that, yes, has tag teamed onto it, but it's still utilizing massive amount of infrastructure that had to be put down. It's a technology that is constantly growing, and it needs to be refined, but it's highly subsidized, and it's, I just think that as you sit there and argue for freedom and the available of information, it's still, I don't believe it's from the public at hand. It's mainly from a governmental institution that has set it up and implemented it for us to use.
Yeah, I would disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with that, too.
I'm glad you guys do, but it's...
When you look at the services that are quote-unquote free, any of the services that you deem to be free, you're the product.
Yes.
Exactly. Your information is the value there.
Yeah, you're the...
It's a trade-off.
But that's why
you're,
it is.
You're the value-add product,
and we consider it free.
We think that it's free, but and like we kind of talked about a little bit before we started today, was what is the price of free information? Us receiving free information from the internet, do we then in turn, we consider it free because we don't have to shell out dollars for it,
but it's not free.
The actual cost of that supposed free lunch is us relinquishing our privacy.
Yeah, you relinquish your privacy to governmental and corporate agencies that utilize that information in different ways, either sell it off via advertising, marketing, or data collection. So, and that infrastructure is paid for, by that financial activity. So, you know, while there may be infrastructure costs associated with that, the margins on individuals using the internet is the margin value is quite high for governmental and corporate interests. So,
here's a better analogy: it's free.
It's not free.
If government wasn't there, would the internet?
Yeah,
be there.
Sure it would. Yeah. Google makes tens and hundreds of billions of dollars in advertising revenue by wrapping around, by collecting your data and selling it to marketers who want to micro market to what your interests are.
So, yeah, when somebody tries to suggest that the internet only exists because of government intervention and creating it, no, that's complete fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Somebody would have capitalized on the opportunity just because they saw the open opportunity there.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt.
Anything that's free isn't free. You're giving up data.
All right. Well, let me rephrase.
Even our podcast.
Let me rephrase this.
We collect thoughts of people.
If the federal government wasn't set up and so large as what it was, would the internet ever be what it is today?
Oh, it was developed by the government.
I mean, but let's say the say there's a massive EMP that goes off that destroys our solar flares, whatnot, that destroys our infrastructure of electricity and whatnot. What's going to be formed from there on? When say all of a sudden the internet's confined to just city to city. You know, in your localized area, it's not global. I just, I don't know to me, there's just something lurking in the back of my mind with a problem with this, free information out there that we take it for granted. It's something that's not fully paid for and has created this culture of more and more dependency on the government.
Yeah. No, I disagree again.
I would disagree with that. Yeah.
I disagree too. Yeah. I think
to say that the internet is our source of dependence on the government, I would disagree with anything remotely. Yeah.
The government does not provide the internet. We pay for ISPs. Yeah, pretty sure.
It's private.
All of us, all five of us, currently pay for two different accesses to an ISP, both your home internet connection and your cell phone. That infrastructure is paid for through our own pocketbooks. It doesn't come from the government.
Yeah, and that's granted by the government.
No, it's not.
Well, and not to mention, what is it that mesh networks where people can create their own network?
That's cool. Yeah.
One of your friends at the Liberty meeting was talking about that.
Mike Ludwig. Yeah, he's working on that, and there are some apps on iPhone that are available for iPhone and Android, which allow you to set up basically phone-to-phone. Your phones basically turn into wireless access points where you can mesh them together, and you can form your own private networks outside of the public internet and communicate that way. So if you wanted to set up web services or, you know, messaging services outside of the public internet, you could do that. So, you know, situations where that's useful is if you may not have even links to the internet. Maybe you're out in the mountains somewhere and you still want to communicate amongst people. You have, 10, 50, 100 people that, want to communicate and, send text messages or whatever, and you can do that. Or eventually, kind of the idea, or, some of the really avid mesh network architects is to form an internet outside of the public internet, where you're not susceptible to NSA monitoring, where you're basically you build out your own internet via mesh networks, and it's a realistic scenario. Going forward, you could Google mesh networks and you can see, projects that are going on around the world where the idea is to basically build a free public internet powered by private infrastructure. that's not dependent on commercial infrastructure like ISP infrastructure, anything along those lines. And I had an issue there.
Oh, go ahead.
But that's a real, it's a viable alternative.
So if you're on a mesh network, one thing I don't understand is if you're on a mesh network, can you only access the things on that network that other people in your network have posted, or can you see the rest of the internet, or is it just what's within your
It really depends on how that mesh network is set up.
Yeah, it depends if you have backhaul into the public internet or not. You could have your mesh network set up, and if one of the nodes on the network has access to the public internet, then you could access anything on the public internet over that connection, which you'd call a backhaul connection. Or if you have no external or egress connection onto an internet connection outside of that, you'd be just confined to the mesh network. So you can really architect it to go either way.
But what good does that do?
Well, you have privacy.
You're anonymized essentially through the mesh network.
Yeah.
Isn't it like encrypted going up and going down? So both packets sent and received.
It's different.
Like that?
That's different. Encryption. Encryption is something that's created by the connection that you're making to the specific website that you're trying to go to, or the specific connection you're trying to make.
Device to device.
Yeah. So there's, but the encryption's not absolutely necessary because now you've only got one point of connection for all of the devices that are connecting to that network.
And you're cut off from, you really aren't too concerned about encryption if you're not connected to a public internet connection.
Yeah, but how long do you think this will be legal?
That people can identify what you're doing. So, like, if I'm on a mesh network and there's an egress, I think you called it, to the regular internet.
Yeah.
So if I run a Google search, can they still tell where that's coming from? Or
it depends again. Your computer has several identifiers on it just by default, plus.
Right, like the IP address is one of them, right?
And then IP doesn't really mean much in this kind of a scenario. We're talking about something called a MAC address.
Yeah, or if you're even connected to the public internet, that's what really matters. Yeah, so.
But if you are, you're still exposed by your MAC address, and on top of that, there's other ways that you could be identified, meaning. Like you bring your laptop and you've got Chrome set up, and Chrome by default signs in your email.
You'd have to have an internet connection to be able to reveal.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Speculating that you've got an egress and an internet connection on your mesh network, you could still be identified just based on those.
Yeah, but you would have to have that connection. If you didn't, then it's basically secure anonymous communication without any outbound or egress connection into, a public internet. The mesh network idea is interesting.
How long do you think it's going to be legal?
Well, you can't make it illegal.
Why not?
It's just a form of connectivity. You can't make ham radio communication illegal I can't see any legal workarounds to make that a workable solution.
Well, if all of a sudden every neighborhood had a mesh network set up, there'd be no need to utilize Comcast, Time Warner, or any internet connection.
It's a disruptive technology.
It would be highly illegal if that ever happened It goes back to my point that most fiber optic has been laid by the government.
Yeah.
And they rent it out to these corporations.
No, most of it's been laid by corporations.
Counties and towns don't pay for fiber optics to run through them?
But most even municipal fiber is taken care of. It's contracted out to private vendors. So there isn't a lot of, when you look at that, there isn't a lot of government activity in that area.
It's almost all commercial. But yeah, to Chelsea, the mesh networking idea is it'll be more and more interesting because you can potentially you could set up mesh networks just by setting up cell phones as nodes in a network, and you know eventually it'll be an interesting challenge for the cable industry, you know, for the ISP industry to take on, because Facebook is working on technologies like that, Google is working on technologies like that to basically work outside of the confines of, you know, Comcast and Time Warner and, you know, companies that, mm-hmm. you know, they throttle different services that are threatening to them, like they've done that with Netflix mm-hmm. and other services. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there are, you know, there are companies and then, you know, private groups that are working on mesh technologies. And that to me is the future of the internet and networking. It's one of the interesting things that will happen in the next 10
years.
Is there
a proximity issue? I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. So like a mesh network, is that like a local thing or is it something that can be done globally?
Well, it's locally and, you know, then by extension can be done globally, but you know, it is.
You can grow it.
Yeah. But it is.
Specifically describe how a mesh network works. Generally, it's done through wireless technology.
Yeah.
The FCC regulates how strong of a radio frequency you can use for wireless technology. And that, therefore, limits the overall distance that you can have for your radio frequency for communication.
Right.
Which a mesh network generally, when you're talking about a situation like what Ludwig was talking about, requires a lot of nodes that encompass an area where an event is going on instead of something where you'd kind of encompass a town or a neighborhood, which we've seen in Chaska fail miserably. But the mesh network
was more
is actually
wireless. That wasn't really mesh.
Okay, it wasn't mesh, but it was public Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it was public Wi-Fi.
It's kind of the same scenario when you're talking about doing a mesh network in a city. It would be done kind of the same way.
No, it's a
you'd
different.
Have it.
It's apples and oranges. They're different technologies, really. Because you have you know, in Chaska, you basically have access points on, you know, top of you know, electrical poles or intersection, you know, stoplight intersection towers or buildings, and you'd link in access points to that. But you wouldn't be connecting, you know, cell phones or, you know, various wireless devices together in a autonomous network. So they're two different things.
Okay, but what Ludwig was talking about was not that. So
yeah, he was talking about phone to phone mesh networking. That like at AgoraFest, which is what he really wants to use this for, because they're out in the boonies and they, you know, access is prohibitive, and they'd like to be able just to communicate amongst themselves. Is, you know, have, you know, a way to do that, which is different than what Chaska. You know, just with their Wi-Fi.
Okay, well, the understanding that I had of it was different.
Yeah.
It's different. But you know what I think we could totally do?
Yeah.
We could totally hire unemployed people to walk around with hotspots. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but unemployment in the U.S., that's something to talk about.
Yeah. Is that your segue?
I can't even pretend like these are clever anymore. I'm just going with them.
Yeah, but thanks to you, Matt, at least we get there. You know, I think if it weren't for you, I don't know if we'd ever get there.
I try to get us to move on eventually.
Well, I can play. I'll throw out a clip here. And,
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, we can. I don't know. This is, it may or may not be good, but I'll roll it here.
Words of Steve Stanley of Pierpont Securities, perhaps the most boring jobs report we've seen in some time, because everything came in pretty much as expected. An 8,000 miss is nothing. It's a rounding error in this world. But what it tells you is that the economy is still on track. The best news in the report was the unemployment rate not going down, because 503,000 people came into the workforce. More people think the economy is getting better, think they can find jobs, and so they're going out and looking for work. And that tells you at least that maybe we're on a track to see some improvement as the year goes on. The weather snapback, not as much as people thought, but still back on track. And that's good enough.
Mike, in the commentary that I've seen, some are pointing to wages as disappointing aspect of the report. Is it fair to describe it that way?
Yes and no. Yes, it was a disappointment in that it came in flat this month, but we had a 0.4 increase in February, which was double the average of previous months. So if you average the 2 months, you're still at a 0.2
Your
increase.
Your rolling average looks smoother.
It's an improvement, but it isn't the kind of improvement we need to really get people out there spending more, but at least it's moving in the right direction.
All right, Michael, thank you for giving us the latest, really for breaking it down for us. We want to watch. Seems the market we're not even an hour later, almost seems unchanged at this point.
Well, that's because the Fed's not involved in this. I mean, they've given us their timeline. They're not going to change based on one report. But you know who is watching this with interest is Mario Draghi, because this didn't suggest that the Fed's going to have to increase their timeline. So that's pushing the euro higher. And that's a problem for him, because it continues their disinflationary problem and their slow growth problem. So our jobs.
So what do you guys think about the unemployment rate? Because it's now down below 7%, right?
I don't know. It's hard for me, because I had this conversation recently, and I explained that I was talking to a friend who's wondering how the job market is. He's been in the Air Force for 10 years. He's in Japan. He's going to move back home here. And he's, you know, how good's the job market? And I said to him, I'm like, honestly, I don't have a single person who I know right now who wants a job who's not employed.
Yeah. Well, we have very low unemployment in Minnesota, too. It's below 5%. It's like 4.6%.
So to me, that's remarkable. I remember in 2008 when I myself was unemployed for a short period of time, and then I knew several other people who had lost jobs at the same time.
Yeah, it was
tough. And finding work was difficult.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a lot of layoffs. And, yeah.
Yeah, I know that I had a time after I graduated college trying to find a job. It took me over a year to find a job that fit my credentials and experience. It took a while, and it was a little frustrating, but you stick in there long enough. But like I said, I like you guys said, I don't know anybody that's looking for work that can't find it right now.
Yeah.
But that just might be the people I hang out with, so.
Yeah, and I think it's really the area that we're in, too. And, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, the unemployment rate is very low. And especially in the Twin Cities, it's a, you know, the employment pool is pretty highly educated, and there's a lot of demand.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the IT industry where Matt and I work, the unemployment rate is below 2%, and that's actually below the natural unemployment rate, which I think is like 2.5%. That's for people who are moving or between jobs or whatever. So it's it's a pretty competitive market, but I think mm-hmm. I mean when you hear the stories about chronic unemployment, it just, I mean, there are educational issues that are there, you know.
Absolutely. We were talking about in one podcast that there are all these engineering jobs that might remain open for over a year because they don't have candidates that are qualified.
Yeah.
And so we see this huge gap between the jobs that are open and what's required to be able to fill them successfully.
Yeah.
And then the people who don't have jobs who are looking for them. And the biggest piece that we see is training, education, and experience.
Yeah.
And I think part of it has to be a growing pain from the type of economy and the types of jobs that were available for so long, whether they be in manufacturing or something of that nature, moving towards a more intellectual labor-based economy where people do need that education and they do need that training. And the more intellectual talents and, you know, training that goes into being able to fill the needs of today.
Yeah. And especially amongst the older, displaced, unemployed who may have been in manufacturing jobs or, you know, low skill jobs, it's a mm-hmm. tough situation for them. But if there's a silver lining for that type of individual, there are a lot of jobs and various trades that are available that you can go to community colleges or technical colleges to really get the necessary skills to qualify for those jobs. And a lot of times it's really a matter of going back to school for a couple of years, and you don't need to go, to a university where, you're paying $20,000 out of pocket per year. There are a lot of trade schools that can provide the necessary skills, for much less than that, you know, these people can get back on their feet. But in my mind, that's an issue of educating those people on, you know, the fact that those opportunities are available and, you know, getting them back and educated and into the workforce.
Well, part of it's pride too. Yeah. I mean, so I was a teacher at the Minnesota School of Business up until the end of the year here. Mm-hmm. And that school actually has a lot of people of all ages, not right. just, you know, high school graduates.
Yeah.
So I'd have people in my classes that were in their mid-40s or maybe even 50.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so, I was so impressed by that, because a lot of people, once they're 50 or 45, they say, well, I can't go back to school. You know, it's this pride issue as well. Like, we associate school with something for young people.
Yeah, but they
instead
can't.
Of saying, you know, instead of saying, well, it doesn't matter what age you are, you can always learn. Of course, there's the calculation you have to do from how much more money will I earn over the remainder of my career as opposed to how much will I pay in tuition. Of course, that's a valid calculation that needs to be made. And so if there are these opportunities at a technical school that could provide you with more earning that would overcome the cost of the education itself, then that's a wonderful thing. But part of it is people thinking, well, I'm too old for school, or how embarrassing for me to be a student again sitting amongst a bunch of young kids. I do believe that that's a valid concern people think of.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, you know, people are living longer now and they're working longer, you know, so even if, you know, if you have students in that age group, you know, that should be motivated by necessity, right, rather than pride, and you know, be willing, you know, maybe to take your lumps and, you know, understand if you maybe go to a technical school and are trained in, you know, robotics or, you know, construction or some other type of trade that's going to have a long-term tangible value, that you're willing to do that. It's unfortunate if people, you know, if some people have that mindset. But on the flip side, and I'm sure, you know, we've all run into people like this, is that there's, for whatever reason, there are kids who go to college and they pursue liberal arts degrees and degrees with, you know, with not a lot of utility, and they're frustrated by being strapped, you know.
What are you talking about, Eric? I love my communications degree.
Art history. Yay.
Yeah. I mean, we all know people like that, I think,
Well, when I was first going to college, I was really into philosophy and psychology, and I wanted to get a philosophy degree. And my dad said, hell no, you're not getting a philosophy degree. Are you kidding me? He's like, no, you want to do philosophy, you do it in your free time. And I thought he was just so mean. At the time, I was like, oh, he's crushing my dreams.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a horrible thing to hear when you're 18 years old, you know. But it was funny. We actually had a falling out, and I discontinued my education ties with my father. Well, I ended up going out and going to school separate from him. And when it came down to it, I thought, okay, well, what makes the most sense for my life? You know, what would provide me with a good backbone and a nice safety net? You know, so if I do want to go pursue my dreams, I've got something to cover me. And,
yeah.
You know, all my dreams of going into philosophy, what did I do? Accounting. You know, and that's part of, you know, making practical decisions. Is it the most exciting and fun and creative thing I could be doing? No, it's not. But I think that when people go to school, they have to really connect that with a career for their future. And if I go and get an art history degree, well, yeah, maybe I can have some great cocktail conversations with people. But is that going to translate into something that will support a family or support my life?
You're expecting and if you're not way thinking too much about, out of people.
How was that expected? I mean, and I think maybe part of the issue, too, is that when you're 18 years old, your brain isn't nearly done developing. And most people, and I don't know if it's just me, but most people, I would assume, at 18 don't know who they are yet, nor do they know what they want. And we posit people to make these huge, huge decisions that will impact the rest of their lives when they're 18. And from a, you know, cognitive standpoint, still in some very formative stages. It's a tough time to be able to make a really rational, well thought out decision for the rest of your life at that age.
I don't know. I'm 30 years old and I still don't know who I am.
Exactly. Point there. Yeah. Checkmate. You know, they show that some really critical decision making parts of our brains don't start to really finish developing until our mid-20s.
Yeah, and it's later for guys.
Is it later?
Well, guys, it's like 3 or 4 years later.
Oh, yeah. Well, you guys. Yeah. But at 18, I mean, we're asking young people to make some pretty big decisions. And I mean, especially if you think about going to a school that's maybe $30,000 a year, which isn't even in the highest range. I mean, you're talking about the amount of money that you could spend on a house. And what if you make the wrong decision when you're 18? Then what? Do you spend another $120,000 going back and redoing it?
Well, what's college? I didn't know college was a workplace for you to become a slave to some organization to go work for. I thought it was education.
Yeah, it is education, so that you can build your skill and utility to be able to make your life awesome.
I don't have a television at the moment, so YouTube is sort of my main source of entertainment. and there's an awesome video or interview that Reason TV did with, I don't know if you're familiar with, like, the TV show Dirty Jobs. It was on, like,
yeah.
Discovery Channel. Or, I don't know. Yeah. I never watched it, but I know who the guy is. He's in a bunch of commercials and something, too. I forget his last name.
Mike Rowe.
Mike Rowe. And they did an interview with him, Reason TV did. It's maybe about an hour long, 50 minutes or so. But they talked about a lot of what we're talking about now and, effective or responsible or you know, long-term good decisions in terms of educational and vocational training and those choices. And I didn't agree with – I don't know if I agreed with all of it. I'd have to watch it again. But the majority of it was really, really well done. I really thought it was really good. I'll have to post that.
Oh, there's a quote from that absolutely lines up with what you're saying, and it's Mike Rowe. He said, if we are lending money that ostensibly we don't have to kids who have no hope of making it back
yep.
in order to train them for jobs that clearly don't exist,
Yeah.
I might suggest that we've gone around the bend a little bit.
Yeah, have you?
Well, I don't understand why college is just there to train you for a job.
Well, hey, if you're a truck kid who doesn't have to work for the rest of his life and you can just go off and get a art history degree and you don't have to worry about actually bringing an income, you go right ahead. You know, and obviously anybody who wants to go and spend 120 G's to just, you know, learn something like philosophy, you go right ahead. It's not a requirement. But if we're talking about making choices that will better your future and the future of your family, well, then we have to think about, does this degree help me in those endeavors?
We don't have to force that decision on anyone.
I'm not suggesting that we do. Nobody is suggesting that we force people to make good decisions.
Well, to me,
the
cost
of college
is
being a libertarian, as far as I'm concerned.
Irrelevant, because the cost is continual from if you go to school in preschool, kindergarten, first grade, whenever you start, there's a cost from that point on. You spend, I guarantee, more on average, more is spent on per child through their first 12 years of education than they do in college on average. And and we're sitting here harping on college. I just don't understand why college is set up to make you get a job. I mean, that's just what a technical college is.
Are you saying why isn't high school preparing people for life? Is that the question?
I don't see why
not providing people with the skills necessary to live their lives and be productive?
Why not be a communist governance then and just throw people in these certain work schools, and because we will need these workers and we'll just train them? And
I think you're taking a leap, because here's the difference between government intervention and personal choice. If I want to go and get a philosophy degree, I can go ahead and do that. But I also know what kinds of options are available for me when I'm done.
My argument is it's a scam that you go to college and you get it work. That's why they accept all these.
It worked for me.
And it's
anybody else?
No, yeah, it's a valid institution. I think it's not valid. I say it's
a worthy goal, and that's actually when you're actually able to go and pursue certain things that actually interest you or whatnot. But
Kirk, from what I'm hearing, you view college as an instrument to grow critical thinking, skill sets that are of interest to you, and it shouldn't be a vocational endeavor. That's basically what you're arguing, right?
It actually gets closer to a free market. Most everyone, it goes to a public school that it's a standardized unit that is forced upon everyone. And then all of a sudden you get to college where you can actually pick the classes you want to do, and you're actually responsible for it. You have to actually learn how to study. And it's like the maturation of an individual that all of a sudden already decided to go to college. Now you can actually go get your education. And I just don't,
Are you pointing out the fact that we don't have, are you arguing not against college, but against?
I'm not arguing against college at all.
No. I'm saying, in order to understand where you're going with this, are you saying why are we not giving those options and opportunities to people prior to college years?
I just don't like the whole harp on people choosing faulty degrees or whatnot. If they want to choose that, that's fine. But
they're not marketable. They can reap the consequences of it.
Exactly, precisely.
Yeah, but people, you know, there are a lot of individuals who pursue those degrees who are then indebted significantly, and
what Kirk is advocating is personal responsibility in your educational choices.
I would not argue against that.
Yeah.
Yes, and I don't know. I just didn't like the direction of the conversation, and I should have butted in earlier to make it more relevant to the times at hand. But
Anyway,
sorry. I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody getting an art history degree, but, I mean, if, you know, 5-10 years later you're bitching about the fact that you can't get a job, well, that's part of the whole decision, then follow, there's a consequence.
And it seems to me that the majority of people who complain about inability to find gainful employment fall into those categories. And they're, you know, and they're loaded with debt, or, you know, like, I didn't sign up for this. And they, you know, they just don't, for whatever reason. And I think that's not unnatural when you're going through, university or college, and you're studying philosophy or art history, you don't really think about the ramifications until you're done. Cause you're going through there and you have your loans, and it's like, you know, this is what I'm doing now. And then once you're done, then you're confronted with reality, right?
Right. $800 a month student loan payments. I mean,
yeah.
And then you got what, a $30,000 a year job waiting table. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's actually more student loan debt in the U.S. than there is total credit card debt. Like, let's think about that for
a second. Significant problem.
Is that true?
Yes. That is absolutely true. There is
more. That's freaking horrible.
I know. Considering the amount of credit card debt we have, yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
And that's a racket.
It's creating slaves. That was my argument. College has turned into
racket.
A slave-running organization. We're all bitching about college debt. How much dollars are we paying for every student to go to local high school, elementary school, everything? It's all a scam. The amount of money in education at any level is absolutely ridiculous.
I think public education is important, or education in general. As much as
has anyone else seen this? But I've been starting to see more and more situations where instead of having a traditional homeschool, you have a collection of families within a community or a couple town radius that will collaborate homeschooling. Have you guys seen that pop up in your area?
A lot of people homeschool like 2 or 3 days a week, and then they have. And then they all meet up for 2 or 3 days a week.
Yeah, or they take part-time at a public education and part-time homeschooling. Yeah, I haven't heard of this collaboration, though. That's interesting.
I haven't either.
Yeah, so instead of having one parent try and teach math and English and everything else, they kind of say, I understand I have strengths in this area and weaknesses here. So then it's more of a collaborative effort between several different families. To provide a more holistic approach to homeschooling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really, really interesting approach.
I think in that reality, we've got opportunities for private institutions to fulfill the same need. The problem is that the majority of the time that's cost prohibitive. Sending a kid to I believe personally that a voucher system would resolve that altogether.
Oh, yes. You're speaking my language now. But I mean, in Brazil, there is the education system is primarily private, but because of their, you know, so the average, I want to say the average tuition is something like $5,000 a year, which for a lot of people in low-income families is unreasonable, and I understand that. But if we could maybe do a hybrid between vouchers and some sort of privatized system, I think we could come up with a really great working model where we're not seeing the lack of payoff that we are with our current system.
Oh, what's the average cost of sending a kid to school in Minnetonka these days? I think it's something like $17,000 per pupil.
Is that true? That seems a little high, but
yeah, Minneapolis is in the 20s.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've heard around 9,000.
Yeah,
No, that is so low. I'll look it up right now.
I was gonna say my estimate just with having no actual information, my guess would be like 10, 12,000 a student.
Yeah, I heard from someone who works in the school system that it was somewhere like 9 or 10.
Yeah, I was going to say about 10 would be my guess. Maybe 12, and, depending on, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like...
I just found something that says the average cast is 12,000, so...
Yeah, I showed that too. Yeah.
And that's average. So now when we talk about Minnetonka... Yeah. Give you a little more.
I have United States revenue per pupil, and that was 12,000 as of 2011, at least.
Oh, Minneapolis Public Schools spends 23,000 per student.
I was going to say, when you get to Minneapolis, it's going to be more.
Yeah. Well, there are outliers.
Their education is awful.
Yeah, it's absolute horseshit. So.
Well, and I watched a documentary on this a few years ago, but the most funding, if you look at it from a nationwide perspective, the highest funding goes to the lowest performing districts. So inner city.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, the logic is, you know, to try and fix it, but that's
kind of the ethos of every government program we have. If something's broken, we'll just throw more money at it, and that'll make it better. Instead of saying the system itself is broken and we need to fix it, they just say, well, let's just do it harder, and that'll make it work.
Right, and if you have, a lot of these, I watched a documentary or some program about this a couple weeks ago, and I mean, if you have a failing school system that is throwing all of this money at, you know, administration or
that's where most of the money goes to,
or is misusing its money, and you're not providing any form of competition to, you know, force that school to adapt or to improve. Who's to say throwing more money at it isn't going to just, you know, increase the line the pocketbooks of those, you know, administrators? It's
right, absolutely.
And the sad situation is most of the money does go to bureaucrats or administrators within the district.
Yep.
So here's the data that I found now. It's a district comparison, Minneapolis versus suburban districts. It's not Minnetonka, but it's Eastern Carver County, which all of us who are talking on this program know Eastern Carver County happens to be the schools that were in the districts that we were doing a lot of campaigning in. Minnetonka may not qualify as that because it's actually considered Hennepin County. But
Eastern Carver County schools is Chanhassen High School and Chaska High School.
Chaska, yep.
Yeah.
So those two, the average expenditure per student for that district is $19,136 a year. So it's a lot. It's not a small amount. And $19,000 a year per student in a private institution is one hell of a nice private institution.
I don't think Benilde or Breck or Andover are getting anywhere close to that amount per year.
I guess not.
I think my private high school was $6,500.
Yeah, but that was in 1950.
There has been quite a bit of inflation since then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know I've been a student of both private and public education. I am fortunately, I can't speak to homeschooling other than word of mouth, but it was just night and day for me, the education that I was provided from my public institution as opposed to the private one. So, for example, I took French at my private school for like 2.5 years, and I would come home and visit my friends that I knew from public school who had taken French for 4 years, and they were the equivalent of where I was at about 3 months in. I mean, it was just absolutely ridiculous.
I can vouch for that. I can vouch for what you're saying. I took 7 years of French, and I was an A student, and I did not know a thing. because I had a very good French accent, I got a very good score.
You know, and I tutored extensively, you know, throughout my life, including in college, and I would tutor other fellow college students in both English and math, and I would tutor kids who didn't, well, I shouldn't say kids, they were adults. They were adults with high school diplomas, and they were incapable of dealing with fractions. They couldn't add or subtract decimals. They couldn't create a comprehensive statement or sentence or paragraph in their first language. And these people had high school diplomas. And it was just really sad. And it wasn't an exception. It was over and over and over again. I see this. It's not like, oh, one or two kids slipped through the cracks. No. It's a plague. They just get passed over and passed over. And the next teacher, you know, they pass them. And then the next teacher is supposed to deal with it. Well, then they pass it to the next one and then just hand them a diploma to get them out of the system when they can't do these really fundamental things that will help them in their life. I mean, we aren't giving people skills to survive in the real world. I mean, if I were to be a little bit cynical here, I would say that the only point of having our education system as it stands is just to be able to get an opportunity for open ears of young, impressionable children to provide propaganda to, because I don't see a whole lot of functionality beyond that.
It's daycare, so the parents can go to work.
I mean, with all the money that we pour into this, we can obviously see that there isn't a very strong correlation between the amount of dollars spent and the quality of education provided. So what is it that we're paying?
So how does education relate to jobs? How does college
I think it does.
Well, it makes you a smart person, but it doesn't have anything to do with our topic of unemployment.
Much, much more strongly correlated between your eventual success than your IQ is. You can be smart as the day is long, and if you can't be emotionally smart, if you can't read people and be charming, then your chance of making it in this world is much less than someone whose IQ might be, you know, 89, but they're really good with people. And that's
not making it in this world. The pursuit of happiness is so,
Talking about vocation. If you want to talk about happiness, we can get into that.
We're talking about employment here, Kirk, not happiness.
The pursuit of happiness, to me.
Is.
To pursue the life you want to live. And therefore, today's standards say, all right, you got to go to college. You got to graduate high school, then go to college. Get the correct degree is what I've been hearing. Then go out and find a job that someone's offering to you.
Well, I think the argument there, Kirk, is that, you know, yes, we believe in liberty. Yes, we believe in pursuing, you know, the pursuit of happiness, pursuing your own individual interests and preferences and doing things that interest you and that make sense for the way you want to live your life. But with the understanding that if what we want is to live, you know, in a freer society, in a society that you know values liberty, that under such a society they comes along with that goes along with personal freedom, personal liberty. So
yeah, but all I've been hearing is, oh, if you go to college, get the right degree, you'll find a job with the right company. It'll transcend, you know, you just follow the system properly and you'll just do well in life or whatnot.
Sorry,
I'm hearing Chelsea talk in the other room on mute because I can't hear her.
I forgot to unmute. I'm sorry about that. So I actually watched a documentary. Oh, it was a TED Talk yesterday that I watched that showed that. No, it wasn't a TED Talk. It was a series called Happy. And they have all these people in what's called positive psychology. So instead of just studying
deviations
or studying deficiencies, they're studying the psychology of happiness. And they've shown that about, have you seen that?
Is it like a documentary kind of?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is that they've shown that the correlation between happiness and like our social status or the amount of money we have or the profession we have or our race or our age and all of that really only ends up affecting about 10% of our happiness. And about 50% of it is inherited. 10% is from our situation in the world. And then about 40% of it is the actions we take on a daily basis. So if we exercise, that will release dopamine. If we spend time with our family or, you know, so the intentional actions that we take on a daily basis account for 40% of
our giant bong load.
But at the same time, society tells us that the things that we really need to be paying attention to, like our careers and our social status, only account for about 10% of it. Right. So four times more than that. And the thing that we don't necessarily pay attention to nearly as much that society doesn't stress as the key factor in whether or not we're going to be happy is really what defines it is I exercised or instead of, you know, taking my run on the same route that I always do, I changed it up a little bit. I deviated from the same pattern or I decided to look up at the sky for 5 minutes today.
Like
those
tonight.
Intentional decisions comprise 40% of our happiness. So
the blood moon.
It's an entirely different conversation between, you know, whether education is this or that or whether it should leave the job. Happiness is an entirely different conversation. And there are people in this world that live in abject poverty that are, you know, from a chemical point of view, just as happy as we are.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
My point is the jobs aren't there. College is a good thing, but it's not set up for you to go just work for someone. And that's what they teach you to do. And it's.
I disagree with that. I absolutely disagree with that.
I think the, when you're talking about education, if you're talking about unemployment and education, people, you know, you should just go into the areas that interest you the most and you're going to be fine. If you have if an individual has
with the asterisk of personal responsibility and accountability for your choices.
Oh,
right.
Thank you for adding that.
Yeah, no problem.
But, you know, for the most part, if an individual follows a course of interest and they have a passion in that area, they're generally going to be okay.
Well, and actually, there was a study I just watched about that very thing that showed, it was an article I read online where, so typically the paradigm in America is such that success leads to happiness. But this article purported that instead of us believing that success leads to happiness, we need to reverse that and understand that happiness leads to success. They found that when people are happier, that success naturally follows.
And you're happier if you're doing something you enjoy or, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're pleasant to be around. You get along better with other people, and there's more positive reactions. A greater network grows. There's more opportunities for you. Ability to react to stress in a positive way as opposed to a deconstructive way. They've seen the correlations with that in happiness. And they've just shown that you react better in stressful situations. You overcome challenges better when you're happier. And so instead of thinking of, I have to become successful and then I will be happy, well, the problem is that our definitions of success continually change. Once we obtain an achievement, so whether that achievement is, for example, graduating high school, well, now you have a new achievement ahead of you, which is graduating college. And now you have a new achievement ahead of you, which is getting a career. And then the next one is, you know, advancement in that career. And, you know, so there's always going to, that fence keeps moving farther ahead of you. And so you can never just achieve success and say, okay, now I'm happy. You're putting happiness on the other side of the fence between you and what you're doing today and the future. So you're always putting happiness off. It's delayed. It's once I achieve this. But once you achieve that, you put it on the other side of the next fence. And so we never get to a point where we can just be happy if we hold on to that traditional paradigm. Whereas if we readjust and say, instead, it's more important for us to be happy and know that not only from a philosophical point of view, but also from a biological and chemical point of view, the likelihood of our success will follow.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And, you know, if you're talking about unemployment or academic success or whatever, and I think, you know, even you're talking about individuals who are maybe strapped with a large amount of debt, you know, for going through a liberal arts degree, which may be easy for them. But the best course for, in my mind, for any individual is just to pursue what you like, what you have passion for, and don't worry about
Well,
there could be an asterisk, but generally not. Because if you have enough motivation in that area, you're generally going to do just fine for yourself, even if you're not earning much.
Okay, I guess my comment on that is that you pursue your passion or your dream, but not at someone else's expense is more.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, generally, most people that I know who are happy in their careers or happy with their life, they just do what they like and pursue what, you know, that, you know, pursue areas that make them feel fulfilled rather than pursuing fields where they think, you know, like what Chelsea was alluding to, where they think they can, you know, do better for themselves over and over. And you're always pursuing that carrot stick and you're never really, you know, you're not fulfilled. I don't know. That in my mind is the, you know, that's the most fulfilling, you know, fulfilling path. But
I don't know if I agree with that completely, but this conversation could go on and on.
Part of that same Happy documentary thing that I was watching showed, and I actually read a book on this that supports what the documentary said as well. The original book, if you want to look it up, is called Beyond Boredom and Anxiety, and then the documentary itself is called Happy, so there are two separate sources there that both suggest there's this thing that they both refer to that's called flow. And basically, if you were to set it up as a chart with an X and Y axis, one axis would be the level of difficulty of the task that's being presented, and then the other axis would be your skill level in that area. Now, if the task is way too difficult for your skill level and there's a mismatch in that way, people feel anxiety. If the difficulty level of the task at hand is really easy but your skill far exceeds it, then you're going to be bored. Well, there's a sweet spot in the middle where the difficulty of the task that's presented matches your skill level in the area to a certain degree, and that's what they call the flow. And they found that when people can regularly feel or put themselves in a position of flow, that is a much, much, much greater correlation to happiness. And it doesn't have to be something, for some people it can be their hobbies. For some people you can even find it at work. It's just finding an opportunity where what the situation is asking of you is something that matches your ability. And so just really being able to fulfill your potential in a moment. And they describe a flow as when you're in a flow, you won't realize how much time has passed. You're just consumed in that moment-to-moment experience, which is, I could maybe theorize, is being a little bit closer to how it was prior to all of the civilization that we have today, in the day-to-day of the times before all these technological advances and comforts that we have. But they've shown that biologically, chemically, people are much better off when they have frequent opportunities to experience a situation and participate in a situation that asks of them all that they're capable of.
All right. That is a freaking fantastic point. And I think right about now we're going to wrap things up. Wanted to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Chelsea, Lydia, Kirk, and of course Eric, thank you all for joining the conversation tonight, and we will talk to you all next time.